So the plan for this lecture will be to just finish transistorizing model in 1D from the lattice model standpoint. We'll solve it once and for all. And then we'll kind of summarize what we learn from this model and try to extrapolate general lessons about gapped quantum phases. So I'll conclude by just showing you several general properties of gapped quantum phases that really arise from both locality of the Hamiltonian and also finite energy gap. And we'll see how this applies to the transistorizing model. Okay, so let's first just finish up the model solution. So let me again write the Hamiltonian. Okay, and so recall from last time that we performed a Jordan-Wigner transformation that was motivated by finding some operator which can describe both spin flip excitations and domain wall excitations. So we defined these Majorana operators, which are strings of spin operators. Okay, and after defining these operators, the Hamiltonian is simply a free fermion Hamiltonian. It involves bilinears of these Majoranas. Okay. And there is one slight subtlety that I didn't mention last time. So if you translate the operator at the boundary of the chain, so if you look at the L and the first site, then you can see that one can pretty easily check that ZL, Z1 actually is slightly more complicated. Involves the Ising symmetry operator multiplied by this Majorana bilinear. So there is some subtlety regarding the boundary conditions and the Ising symmetry, which I think Yinchen might elaborate more on when he talks about the field theory description. Okay. So this is just a minor subtlety at this point. Okay, so now right, so now we can basically obtain the full phase diagram of this model now that we have this Hamiltonian in free fermion form. So recall that as a function of the transitional G, something interesting happens at G equals J that's directly suggested by the self-dual form of the Majorana Hamiltonian. And in terms of this Majorana description, the two different limits of this model are just different dimerization patterns for the Majoranas. So for large G, or for let's say infinite G, or when J equals zero, all the Majoranas are just dimerized within each spin unit cell. Whereas for G equals zero, they're dimerized in between different unit cells. Okay. And right at G equals J, these intra and inter unit cell couplings have the same strength, so it's really just a uniform Marana popping. Okay. So that's a caricature of what happens in terms of Majoranas. And now we can just solve this Hamiltonian by pretty standard Fourier transform. So before I do that, let me just see if there are any questions.
Just to clarify, is that 12 plus 1 or 12 plus 2?
Which one? This one right here?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's 2L plus 2.
So that's the.
So L consists of two Majoranas and involves this Majorana right here,
I see.
coupled to the first Majorana in the chain.
Sorry, can you explain the configuration in the middle for G equals J, all the.
Right, so for when G equals J, the hopping strength within the unit cell and between unit cells is the same,
Oh, yes.
right? So basically, it's just like a uniform Majorana hopping. Okay, so so let's do a Fourier transform. So we can write each. Okay, so now let me use a slightly different notation. So now let me label each unit cell R. Okay. And let me label the two Majoranas within each unit cell, lambda equals 1 and lambda equals 2. Okay, so each unit cell R has two flavors of Majorana, 1 and 2. So let me now just Fourier transform. So I can write gamma at unit cell R, flavor lambda, as just some linear combination. Of Majoranas with momentum k and flavor lambda. Okay, so this is just a Fourier transform. And note that if I take the dagger of this operator, then I actually get the Majorana at minus k lambda. Yeah, so basically this operator with definite momentum k is also a linear combination of course, the Majoranas in real space. So after this Fourier transform, we can just plug this in into the real space Hamiltonian to get to try to get an expression in momentum space. And so if I plug everything in, I get sum over R I sum over two momenta, one for each Majorana. And then I have these phase factors. And the Majorana's labeled by momentum here. Okay, so I'm just plugging in these Fourier transforms into the real space Hamiltonian. And as you can see, the sum over k prime and r basically forces k prime to be minus k, right? Because you're summing over all r. And so we can further reduce this to just minus summation over 1 momentum of I g minus j e to the minus I k, gamma k 1, gamma minus k 2. Okay. So as you can see, this is this has reduced the problem substantially, because now each k mode just has a very simple 2x2 Hamiltonian, right? So in the space of momentum k and the two species 1 and 2, the Hamiltonian is just some 2x2 matrix. And so, yeah, so each k mode in the space gamma k1, gamma minus k2, has this 2x2 Hamiltonian form. And the spectrum is just given by the norm of these matrix elements. So basically, by taking appropriate linear combinations and occupying or not occupying the resulting complex fermion mode, I get energy that's just given by plus or minus the norm of this. Okay, and that's just plus or minus square root of j squared plus g squared minus 2jg cosine k. Yeah, are there any questions about this? Yeah, basically, at every given momentum k, you should think of there living some complex fermion that can be either in flavor 1 or flavor 2. And it has the Hamiltonian of this form, so we're taking the usual, you know, Pauli matrix linear combinations of the two modes to diagonalize it. Okay, so yeah, so now we have an explicit expression of the first excited state energy as a function of the parameters of the Hamiltonian, right? So I think regarding Marco's question from last week about how this can be reconciled with our perturbative analysis, away from the extreme limits, one can explicitly check that if you just take the derivative of this with respect to g near g equals 0, or with respect to j near j equals 0, you get the right slope you would expect. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and also as this duality, as the Majorana picture has hinted, j equals g is a gapless point. Right, this excitation gap closes at j equals g for the k equals 0 momentum mode. And as a as an exercise, it might be good to just rederive this spectrum at this special critical point, right? So remember that at this critical point where j equals g, we said that the Majorana chain is uniform, right? Right. So here each dot is a Majorana, and it's just uniform hopping along that chain. So at this particular point, we actually don't even need to consider a unit cell with two flavors of Majorana. We can just consider a somewhat anomalous unit cell of having one Majorana in each unit cell with translation symmetry. And then you can derive the spectrum from this perspective and see how it's consistent. Okay, so that might be a useful exercise to check. Okay, so let me. Yeah, so let's summarize the full phase diagram of this model. So as a function of the parameter g, we have this ferromagnetic order, or symmetry breaking order, or GHZ order, depending on how you want to look at this order, on the small g limit. We have just the paramagnetic order that's manifestly trivial on the other limit. And away from each extreme limit, the energy gap comes down all the way down to zero at g equals j. And similarly, from this side, it also comes down all the way to g equals j. Okay. So, so now we want to kind of view these properties in a more general setting. Okay. So let's now let's kind of take a bigger picture. Zoom out from this transistorizing model and just consider general properties of gapped local Hamiltonians. Okay. All right, so so remarkably, just having a finite energy gap can already tell us about many properties of the ground state. Okay. So basically, the gap and locality, which or we sometimes take for granted, both of them control many properties of interest of the ground state. So they control correlations, they control entanglement, and they control stability. Of the ground state. Okay, so now I'll spend some time explaining what I mean by this. So many of the results I will try to motivate a bit, but not prove. The proofs can be quite technical, but in case you're interested in more of the technical details, I refer you to this paper by Hastings. But for now, let me just kind of state the important results. Okay. So it turns out that one very important property of local Hamiltonians, which Hastings used to prove a lot of the following results, is what's called a Lieb-Robinson bound. Let me just briefly tell you what this Lieb-Robinson bound is. So this Lieb-Robinson bound is basically a statement about how local Hamiltonian evolution should still respect causality, right? Which we should have, right? As you know, for relativistic systems, you know, there is this definite speed of light, which bounds how fast signals can propagate. For local Hamiltonians, they're not necessarily relativistic systems, but we expect, you know, some similar bounds on how fast information can propagate. Okay, and the Lieb-Robinson bound makes this precise. So, say we have a local Hamiltonian. H. Okay. And let's say we have two spatially separated operators. Say one at I, one at J. Then the commutator of these operators, if they're spatially separated on disjoint sets, then the commutator is clearly zero. However, if we now evolve an operator in time, so we consider AI of t, which is just evolving the operator in the Heisenberg picture, then, as you can convince yourself, this operator will grow as we time evolve it. It'll start growing bigger and bigger, and so it may not necessarily commute with this operator at J now, right? Because this operator is growing, but the Lieb-Robinson bound bounds how fast. This commutator can grow. Okay. So basically what Lieb and Robinson prove is that, let me just state the result first. They prove that this commutator between the time evolved, A, and just the original B, the norm of this commutator is bounded by this quantity here. So here, C1, C2 are just some not so important constants. D, ij is the separation between I and j. So this Lieb-Robinson bound tells us that this commutator is exponentially small outside some light cone given by an immersion velocity VLR. Okay. So the picture is that so say I have time, space, and I initially start with AI. B at J. Then this operator at AI grows in time, but it grows primarily within some light cone given by a slope VLR. And so this commutator between AI of T and BJ only is appreciable at time dij over VLR. Okay. So to to signal to somewhere very far away, like say by applying some operator A here, you still need to wait some amount of time for you know, someone somewhere else to detect that signal appreciably. Okay. So outside of this light cone, the signal is exponentially small in the deviation from the light cone. Okay. Okay, so this is a important property of local Hamiltonians, which, which as you'll see, you know, is an important ingredient of defining phases of matter. So I'll come back to this bound several times. Are there any questions on this Lieb-Robinson bound? Yeah.
So what exactly characterizes the V?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, it's a non-universal number that just depends on the precise local Hamiltonian.
On the operator,
right?
As well?
Yes, I believe so, yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, one might develop intuition by just, if you have like a decoupled Hamiltonian, clearly no signals propagating, right? But then maybe as you increase interactions between unit cell, that could give a faster VLR, right? Yeah, so there's some, you know, some basic intuition like that. But yeah, it's not universal. It just depends on the Hamiltonian. Yeah, actually, I'm not 100% sure if it's I mean, there's probably one maximum velocity that governs all local operators, but probably for some local operators, you can have a tighter bound. Yeah, like for some, you know, some might not even spread. There's like some symmetry, etc. Right, but there should be one governing all operators. Yeah.
Do we usually know how to get this VLR? Like you said, that there's an intuition involved with like knowing, like gauging what VLR should be. But
yeah,
is there a way to find this coefficient with it, or like, and does it have maximum value? Like you were saying, like unknown maximum value, like C or something.
Yeah, how does one derive this in practice? Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, I'm not sure. I have to get back to you about that. Yeah, it's a good point.
So can you summarize again what this theorem does as well? So it kind of relaxes us to say that like if the two operators commute, if we turn on interaction and evolve, they still commute in a very small time again.
Yeah, that's right. So if you evolve the one operator a little bit, it spreads a little bit after some time, but its overlap with the jth site is negligible.
Yeah.
So it's helpful to imagine really like an operator that's evolving into a linear combination of operators, you know, in a bigger spatial region. But this is saying that the tail, like it's the amplitude of its support at J is exponentially small outside the light cone. Right. So it's only appreciable here.
And the norm is like because we have operator norms there, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think I've been a bit negligent in defining that. I think it's some operator norm, yeah. Yeah, okay, so I'll try to get back to both of you about this question about which norm and which how does one derive the actual loss leads? Good point. Okay. Okay, so the first thing which Hastings was able to do was to apply this Lieb-Robinson bound to conclude several properties of grand states of gap local Hamiltonian. So the first result is the statement. Let's say we have a local Hamiltonian with a unique ground state. And with a finite gap delta. Okay. So then the question is what are the properties of the ground state? And so the first thing he was able to show is some bound on the correlations of the ground state. Okay. So I can't go into detail about the proof here. It's not exactly the most intuitive proof. That's somewhat technical. But just heuristically, at least notice that given an energy gap delta and this Lieb-Robinson velocity VLR, we can at least define a length scale psi, z. I don't know how you pronounce this. We can define some length scale that's just given by the Lieb-Robinson velocity over the energy gap. Okay, so there's some length scale in this problem, right? And so indeed, what he was able to show is that for any local operators, OI, OJ, let's also call this ground state psi zero. Then for any local operators, OI, OJ, the connected correlation function decays exponentially with the separation between the operators. And it decays exponentially with some length scale that's precisely given by Lieb-Robinson velocity over energy gap. Okay. Yeah, so, this is directly applicable to our paramagnetic phase right here, right? So here we have a unique ground state of a gap local Hamiltonian. In the extreme limit, this is just a product state with no correlations. And what this is saying is that even away from this extreme limit, if I have finite J, as long as my energy gap stays open, then everything in this paramagnetic phase has exponentially decaying correlation functions. Okay. Okay, and yeah, so again, Hastings was able to prove this impressive result by using some combination of Lieb-Robinson bound and also some tricks in Fourier transforms. That's a reference to look at for more details. Yeah.
This one's just out of curiosity, but is there a Lieb-Robinson's an upper bound to the speed of propagation of signals? But is there a lower bound, and would it even be useful if you had one?
Well, the lower bound is just zero because a decoupled Hamiltonian, doesn't have any velocity. Right?
But So like given a Hamiltonian that isn't decoupled,
mm-hmm.
is there something like that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. A lower bound, yeah, again, I could imagine, some choice of operators that doesn't grow, right? Some appropriate choice, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, any other questions for now? Okay, so we showed how this is relevant to this phase, the paramagnetic phase, right? But what about this ferromagnetic phase, right? So strictly speaking, there's a subtlety, right? Because I don't have a single unique ground state, right? Here I have the two polarized states or the two GHZ states, right? So this result, as I stated, doesn't immediately apply. However, I think one way of understanding this is that, first let me say how it generalizes to some degenerate ground states. Okay. So what Hastings was also able to show is that, if I do have ground state degeneracy, so now let's say I have a bunch of ground states labeled by some index A. So let's call this ground state degeneracy. Then if we define a ground state projector P naught to be projection onto the subspace of ground states, then another result he showed was that if I consider a slightly modified connected correlation function, so this first piece is the same, but now for the second piece, if I insert this ground state projector in between, then this has a similar exponential decay as before. Okay, so now this case is generalized to ground state degeneracy. We can immediately apply to the case of our ferromagnetic GHZ states, right? So recall that for the GHZ state, the regular connected correlator is long-ranged. However, if I plug in GHZ here, then I get ZI, P naught, ZJ. Right, and now what happens is, okay, so let's say I was starting out with a GHZ plus state. Then what happens is ZJ flips GHZ plus to GHZ minus, right? It just changes that whole phase factor. And then ZI flips it back to GHZ plus. So now for this generalized connected correlation, this thing actually is zero, right? That's consistent with this generalized bound. Okay. So the way to understand this is that for the GHZ state or for other symmetry breaking states, the long range connected correlations come from operators which connect different states in the ground state manifold. Okay. Like the origin of this long-range connected correlator comes from matrix elements within the ground state manifold. It doesn't come from matrix elements between the ground state and excited states above that finite gap. Okay. So basically, this generalized bound is a way to deal with ground state degeneracy and this GZ type states. Okay. And probably a more physical way to put this is that the GZ states only have long-range correlations with respect to local operators which break the globalizing symmetry or which are charged under the globalizing, right? So say like this local Z, right? So in other words, if I consider instead local symmetric operators, let's say O sim, such that they commute with the globalizing symmetry. Now, even for the GZ state, these symmetric operators do have exponentially decaying connected correlators. Yeah, I should really have chosen a better notation. Okay, and this is because if I plug in a symmetric operator into this result here, the symmetric operator is unable to connect different states within the ground state manifold. Right, if I apply a symmetric operator, local symmetric operator to GHZ, then it has zero matrix element to going to the other GHZ. Right. Only charged operators can move within the degenerate subspace. Right. So long story short, from the point of view of symmetric local operators, the GHZ is as good as any other unique gapped ground state.
Sorry, what did you mean by charged operator?
Yeah, sorry, okay. So at the beginning, we noticed that this GHZ is an unusual property, that the connected correlator is long range, right? But this is for a local operator Z that's charged under the Ising symmetry, right? So Z anti-commutes with the globalizing symmetry. Yeah, so it's charged in the sense that it's not invariant, right? Yeah. Yeah, but in contrast, if you consider say some symmetric operator like X or ZZ even, right? Then those all, well, for the GZ state, those are all strictly zero, right? But the power of this is that it applies, not just at fixed point states, right? So this all this relied on was some finite energy gap. So this means that everywhere in this gap, everywhere in the two gapped phases, I have exponentially decaying correlation functions. Just for this side, I have to be a little bit careful. They're exponentially decaying for symmetric operators. Right. Yeah. Any other questions about this?
Question. So when we say when you said the chart is charged because it anti-commutes with the local Ising symmetry, does it just not have to is it enough to just not commute with the symmetry, or does it have to anti-commute to be charged?
Um, I think the fact that anti-commutes is special to this Z2 case, right? You know, in general, as long as you get some non-zero phase factor from conjugating with the symmetry operator, I would say it's charged.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, just in this case, it happens to be minus one. Right? Yeah. Okay, so this is one... one consequence of having just finite gap above the ground state, which is quite remarkable. It's like you have a property of the spectrum of this local Hamiltonian, and that's placing these pretty severe constraints on the nature of the ground state. Right? Okay, so the next property I wanted to just briefly mention is entanglement. Okay, so how much entanglement does the ground state of a gap local Hamiltonian have? And so at least one naive picture one might have is, say I partition my ground state into a subsystem A and its complement outside, then we just learn from one that there's this correlation length that dictates the range of like how far things can be correlated in the ground state. And so I expect from that picture that there might only be some correlations with some length scale psi, the same psi we defined above. Okay. So, so we would expect that the entanglement for this ground state should obey an area law that's just proportional to this correlation length psi multiplied by the size of the boundary, which in this case is just, again, there's just point-like boundaries in 1D. Okay. So, so this is an area law that tells you how entangled can the ground state be, and this is actually rigorously proven in 1D by Hastings, also using some Lee-Robinson bounds and other techniques. Yeah.
Could you just explain that graph again? I think I'm not understanding the diagram.
This right here?
Yeah.
Well, it's a very naive argument. There's not much to parse.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the what we learned is that they're exponentially decaying correlations.
Yeah.
Right? So if I want, you know, a sizable contribution, I should look at operators that are psi apart. Right. So yeah, like this is not by any means a rigorous proof. It's just I just want to have a picture of correlations, you know, having some length scale psi,
right.
And that's where all the entanglement should come from.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So essentially, it's just like saying that like things closer to it are more entangled than things farther away.
Yeah, like you can imagine trying to, come up with caricatures of this ground state, right? And you might imagine that there are some bell pairs across the boundary, right, that are representing the correlations, right, and contributing to entanglement, right? Or you know, a much more precise way is to try to approximate the ground state by a matrix product state, right? So actually, yeah, have you guys seen the problem set yet, or that's coming later? Okay, yeah, so... So in the problem set, you'll have some opportunity to learn about a matrix product state description of the ground state, and you'll see why, you know, it's a good picture for ground states of local gapped Hamiltonians, and that might give a bit more intuition for how a finite correlation length is related to low entanglement, like area law entanglement. Yeah. Yeah. So for now, this is a very rough picture. Just there's some correlation length, and that's where the entanglement is. Right?
So can we say that if we have power law correlations, that will be volume law?
No. So at least not necessarily. So things can get much more interesting when you have long range like power law correlations. And in fact, in the tutorial, you'll see that when the gap closes, right, say at this critical point, you will have a lot more entanglement than area law, but still not as much as, say, some generic random state in Hilbert space. Right? So there's still, you know, structure coming from the fact that you're dealing with a local Hamiltonian ground state. But the fact that you don't have a gap now allows you to violate a strict area law. Yeah. Yeah, so this area law is another special property you get from the gap, and it allows for very powerful numerical techniques like matrix product states. Some of you might have heard of DMRG. These are all pretty much enabled by this entanglement being bounded. Sorry, did you have a...
So this is a general result, right? For any dimension, we have this area law for...
So this is only proven for 1D. For higher D, there are some additional assumptions you need to make to have a rigorous statement, and I think it's believed to be true.
But didn't we say that for 1D, the area law is just saying that the entropy is constant with respect to the system size?
That's right. For 1D, it should be some order 1 number. And indeed, it's some order 1 number that depends on the correlation length.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
So in our TFIM, we have a constant.
That's right. So if you look at the two gapped phases here, like say the paramagnet or the ferromagnet, and we cut the system like that,
mm-hmm.
then we find that there's just some order 1 amount of entanglement. As we make the region A bigger and bigger, we don't get more.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Okay, and the last point I wanted to comment on was basically the stability. Of gapped ground states. Okay, so basically, this comes down to the question: how can we define a phase at all? Right. So here we showed that the energy gap is finite all the way up to this critical point, and same here. So, in what sense are ground states at different points in the phase diagram, say on the same side? In what sense are they related to each other? Yeah. So, when we define a phase of matter, we want to, you know, say a collection of states that are qualitatively similar, right? That only differ in terms of short distance property, but they have the same long distance property. So now we want to make that a bit more precise. And so, now the statement we want to make is that if we have some, if we're tuning some parameter in the Hamiltonian and our gap remains finite throughout tuning the parameters, then the ground states of this family of Hamiltonians are all related by some adiabatic connection. Okay, so you might recall from quantum mechanics that there is this adiabatic theorem that says when you tune a parameter in your Hamiltonian slowly enough, then the ground state is smoothly connected to the ground state at the next parameter. And so indeed you can imagine that this finite gap helps you in the adiabatic context, because how slowly you have to go depends on the energy gap with respect to the excited states, right? However, it turns out that in this many-body setting, just naively applying the adiabatic theorem doesn't quite work. Like for this many-body system, you can check that the time you need to go adiabatically actually still diverges with the whole system size. Okay, this is why many-body systems are so tricky. However, again, Hastings and Wen were able to prove a very, very nice result called quasi-adiabatic continuation. So, so what they were able to show is that if you have some family of Hamiltonians parameterized by some parameter like say G, and the gap stays open throughout that whole family, then there is some local Hamiltonian. H tilde, such that different states along that gapped path are just connected by some finite time evolution with this Hamiltonian, which I haven't specified at all. So the same is that there exists some local Hamiltonian, such that if I time evolve with it, I can move around between different ground states along a gapped path. So I have like say psi naught here, psi one here, and the gap remains finite. So what Hastings and Wen showed is that those two different ground states are actually related to each other by only some finite time evolution. Okay. So this is a very nice result because we know from the Lieb-Robinson bound that finite time evolution cannot change the nature of long-range correlations. Right. So so basically this is just some finite time evolution. So this time evolved is independent of system size, okay? And so, this Lieb-Robinson bound we discussed at the beginning says that time evolving with local Hamiltonian just dresses operators locally a bit, right? So say I'm interested in correlations of this new ground state psi 1, then, okay, so if I call this finite time evolution just some operator u, then this is identical to just looking at the dressed operators in the original ground state, where the dressed operator is just u, oi, u dagger. Right, so just evolving in the Heisenberg picture. Right. So Lieb-Robinson tells us that the effect of u being either a finite depth circuit or finite time evolution just makes oi a little bit bigger by some correlation length. Right. So that means that if my psi naught had exponentially decaying correlations, then the new ground state will also have exponentially decaying correlations. Okay. Yeah, so now we see how we can really think about this gapped phase of matter as a collection of ground states all with the same long distance properties, right? What this means is that the long distance properties, like connected correlations, they all have to remain the same. The only different thing is local properties, right? Like the different states here might differ in terms of their local expectation values. But all that can be accounted for with just some finite time evolution or some low depth circuit. Okay. Okay, so finally, after three lectures, we're finally able to define a quantum phase of matter. So we say that two states, psi 1, psi 2, are in the same phase. If there exists sometimes this is called finite depth circuit, finite depth unitary circuit U, such that it connects the two. So psi 2 equals U psi 1. Okay. So what we've just seen is that the fact that we're going through a family of gapped Hamiltonians naturally defines a short or finite depth. It's not strictly finite depth, just some sublinear depth unitary circuit U that connects different ground states. Okay, so we finally defined phases of matter, and now we've finally seen why, you know, this thing is indeed a ferromagnetic phase, and this thing is indeed a paramagnetic phase. Okay. Okay, so one final point. In treating the ferromagnetic phase as actually a phase, symmetry is again important in this definition, right? So the way I like to view it is that this ferromagnetic phase is, we should only call it a phase if we enforce the global Ising symmetry, okay? And I mean that in two different and related ways. So one way in which that's true is if I enforce the global Ising symmetry, then I'm forced to talk about the GHZ states as the ground states, right? Because those are the ones that respect the global Ising symmetry. And the GHZ states are fundamentally different from the paramagnetic states, right? Because they have this long-range correlation. Right, so the GHZ type long-range correlation you cannot get from a trivial paramagnet by evolving with a finite depth circuit or finite time evolution. Again, from Lieb-Robinson band, right? Basically, the logic is that symmetry forces us to think about GHZ states here, and GHZ states have fundamentally different pattern of correlation than the paramagnet. Okay. The other way of putting this is that the other aspect in which I need to enforce symmetry to define this as a well-defined phase is that if I break the Ising symmetry at the Hamiltonian level, like say if I add some perturbation that involves operators which break the Ising symmetry, like a longitudinal field, Then now the GHZ states are immediately split by this perturbation. So now the ground state really is polarized product states, right? And these polarized product states clearly are trivial, right? These polarized product states can be connected to the paramagnetic product states by a short depth circuit. You just rotate every side from plus to up or down, right? And so indeed, if I consider this enlarged phase diagram where I not only have the transverse field, but I also have this longitudinal field. Before, when H was zero, I have a well-defined ferromagnetic phase. But now with finite H, everything with finite H is now smoothly connected to the paramagnetic phase. Okay? It's only this line in which I have Ising symmetry that I have a well-defined ferromagnetic phase. Okay? And this might remind you of, say, this just a liquid gas transition in classical static, right? Like we know that along the temperature pressure phase diagram, there is like this line of criticality. However, liquid and gas actually are in the same phase. You can go around this tricritical point, right? So it's somewhat similar here in this transitionalizing context. Okay. Let me just end there and take any questions. So I think in the next several lectures, Yinchen will start covering the field theory perspective on all this. So you should bring your blurry glasses and enjoy the continuum. Yeah.